Well, it is great to see you.
Hello, and welcome to the Strange Horizons podcast. This is Susan Groppi, the editor-in-chief of Strange Horizons, welcoming you back for yet another podcast interview. In this episode of the podcast, it's my pleasure to bring you an interview with Mary Robinette Kowal. Our goal with these podcasts, generally speaking, is to present interviews with people who we, or I guess technically I, find interesting and think that you would enjoy hearing from. Mary is one of the first people who I thought of as someone who'd be interesting to interview for a podcast. I first knew Mary as a writer. I've published her in two different venues, first at Strange Horizons, where her story Portrait of Ari appeared in January 2006, and second in the anthology 20 Epics, where my co-editor and I published her story The Bound Man. During the editing process for The Bound Man, I found out that Mary lived in Iceland, which, I have to say, I just thought was cool, because it's Iceland, which is one of those places I've never been to but have heard a lot of stories about, and all of the stories just make it sound more interesting. At the beginning of this year, I heard Mary's voice for the first time, when she recorded several chapters of the audiobook version of John Scalzi's novel The Sagan Diaries. That led me to looking at her website and her online journal, where I learned that Mary has a whole career outside of writing in puppetry. She constructs and works with, performs with puppets for her day job, which I have to say is a much more, I keep using the word interesting, but that's what I keep coming back to. It's a much more dynamic and creative day job, even than most of the writers I know. So that was in itself fascinating. And coming as no surprise to anyone who heard the audiobook that she did for John Scalzi, she has a background in voice acting and radio drama as well. So Mary Kowal is someone, again, who I first encountered as a writer, but has this very active other creative side to her life. She's also the art director for Shimmer, which is a beautiful little print magazine. And we'll have information about Shimmer and all of these other activities linked off of the podcast page. So that's my introduction to Mary Kowal, who, during the course of this interview, I discovered is also every bit as charming and fun to talk to as I had been hoping she would be when I asked her to be my second victim in the Strange Horizons podcast series. So without any further prefacing or introduction on my part, I am pleased to present to you part one of two parts of the Strange Horizons interview with Mary Robinette Kowal. Yeah, I want to thank you for this is only the second of these that I've done, and the first one was with Ben Rosenbaum, who's... But I mean, I've known Ben for years, and it was very... all of the fumbling around with figuring out what I'm doing was actually very comfortable. So you're kind of the slightly more professional guinea pig.
I'll try to be appropriately professional then.
Oh, well, you don't have to be. I'm afraid that I won't. The actual sort of intro part, where I talk about who you are and your professional accomplishments and so on, I'll record that later, because I'm actually kind of awkward doing that when the person I'm talking about can hear me.
Yes, I can completely understand that.
There were two major reasons that I wanted you to be the second podcast victim. the first is just, you have a really cool voice. That'd be a good sort of,
oh God,
good feature in someone who's interviewed. But it's also a lot of it is also that you work in such a variety of media, and I find that really fascinating. So I know I've the first thing on my list, you know, to talk to you about is puppets, mostly because puppets are cool, and I don't know anyone else who does that kind of work.
Which is so funny because for years almost everyone I knew was a puppeteer. I mean, I say in my bio that I'm a puppeteer who moonlights as a writer, and that's really the way I see myself. I mean, I've been a puppeteer professionally for about 17 years now. I started in 89 getting paid to actually, you know, play with dolls for a living, which is a strange and unusual thing. But it turns out that it feeds pretty much exactly the same thing that writing does. And that, to me, is all about world building and storytelling. And with puppetry, you're creating the world from the ground up, from your characters, who you actually get to build. And there's not a huge body of puppet literature, so you're frequently working with brand new stories, which is exciting. And the writing is all the same thing, except that instead of creating a three-dimensional character, I'm creating a character on paper with words. But it's exactly the same impulse, except that I The other fantastic thing for me about writing is that I don't have to share the creative process with someone. I don't have to deal with insane directors. I don't have to deal with scheduling. I can take the amount of time that I need to write something, and that's great.
You can make whatever changes you want to the script, yep. As it were.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I really love that. I mean, I enjoy collaborating. That's one of my favorite things about working in theater, is the collaborative process. But there is something to be said for not having to share that creative process. And then the other thing that, for, you know, the flip side of that is that when I actually sell a story and have an editor, I love being edited, because
really?
Then I love it so much, because the flip side of being, you know, not having to share the creative process is that I'm totally responsible for the creative process. So then when an editor comes along and can be the voice of authority, it's like I can relinquish all of this responsibility and just say, yes, yes, fix it, make it better, thank you.
That's great, and that's such a different kind of attitude than I know many writers have about editing.
Oh, I am just so happy when an editor tells me to fix something, because the vast majority of the time they are right. The times that they aren't, it's usually a matter of me not being clear about what I wanted to have happen in the story. And if I explain it or find another way to fix it, then I can still address whatever problem they had without, you know, having to compromise my vision. But it's usually all about being unclear in the first place.
And then one of the things that the editing process does is help you figure out what was unclear.
Yes, exactly, which I love.
It's almost as though when you get into the editing process with a story, it sort of brings you back into, community is the wrong word because it's only two of you, but a kind of a dialogue. It sounds like that can be frustrating sometimes with the puppetry work.
Well, it's not so much that it's frustrating, it's just the vast majority of the time, it's incredibly rewarding, and I've been extremely fortunate with the creative partners that I've worked with, and most of the time it results, I think, in work that is better and more than I could do on my own. It always causes me to push my envelope, which is, I think, why I like being edited, is because it introduces that collaboration into it. And again, it's like, this is how good I thought I could be, and the editor is then asking me to be better. And anytime the bar is raised, for me, that's good. One of the things, I was an art major in school, and one of the things that I really missed when I started working professionally freelancing is I really missed the art building community. You know, you're always working on something, and there's someone just across the room who's also working on something, and you don't have to, it's not so much that you're collaborating, and it's not even about competition, but there's something about having someone else working that makes you want to be more accountable to your own creative process.
Acknowledging art is something that happens with an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a big fan of believing that art is about trying to communicate something. But you had a question.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was how you learned to do this kind of work. Because I was looking at some of the videos that you have on YouTube, the puppetry technique, puppet creation, rather. Because I guess puppetry is actually using the puppets?
Puppetry is, it's like saying literature.
Okay.
It's a big umbrella word for just discussing the art form.
Okay. Because some of the techniques that you were showcasing for us, or how to make parts of puppets, it's fascinating, and it seems very complicated, and and I was just, it got me curious as to how one learns to do this kind of thing.
Well, that's an excellent question, and you're going to hear me go a little bit into a rote response, because, and I apologize for that. For years, I toured professionally, and after shows, we'd do a Q&A, and this is one of the questions that I get a lot.
I can imagine.
So, basically, I was one of those kids who wanted to do everything, and puppetry does allow me to do that. When I went to college, I was an art major with a minor in theater and speech, which was the closest I could come to combining everything I wanted to do. And I was doing Little Shop of Horrors as the giant man-eating plant. And a professional puppeteer came to see the show. And until that moment, it had never occurred to me that someone would actually give you money to perform with puppets. It just, I mean, who would do that? And she owned a home. She worked 4 days a week and just did puppetry. I have later found out that the reason she was able to do that is because she was in North Carolina and the only puppeteer in a 3-county radius, and the cost of living was very low in that area. But it did make me stop on the spot and change career paths. So in my third year of college, I left to go to the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, Georgia, and to do an internship. And that's where I got most of my formal training. I worked with Dee Braxton, who was the puppeteer who came to see the show, and I worked with her, and by the end of the first summer working with her, she gave me a lot of training. By the end of the first summer, I was starting to be able to support myself on puppetry, again, because of where we were. And I went to do this internship fully intending to go back to school and never did, because I kept working. And that's where you get most of the training. The internship program at the center at that time was amazing. I was performing on stage with, and if any puppeteers are listening, they'll drool, but I was performing on stage with John Ludwig, Jane Catherine Shaw, Peter Hart, Bobby Box, and we were directed by George Latshaw. And saying that I was directed by George Latshaw for the writing community is like saying that I was directed by Isaac Asimov. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a god unto puppetry in the American field. He's actually got the title the Dean of American Puppetry. So it was an amazing experience. And then from there, I went on to do workshops. Every time you go to a, writers have conventions, puppeteers have festivals, and there are workshops at festivals. And so you learn how to build mechanisms or different performance techniques. And then I would also go to the National Puppetry Conference, which again is a week-long intensive. And the paper folding technique that I'm using to build Coraline is something that I learned from a German master puppeteer, Albrecht Roser, and I learned that at the O'Neill. A lot of it is, and there are books, there are scads of books on building, but a lot of it is having been doing this for 17 years and having either seen someone else who had a successful mechanism or frequently having already hit my head against the wall umpteen billion times to solve that problem.
Right.
So...
I mean, the Coraline puppet is one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about also, because you've been, I could talk about it, but how about you explain the...
Sure. Subterranean Press is doing a special edition of Neil Gaiman's Coraline, and Bill Schaefer asked me to create a doll of Coraline, one for Neil Gaiman, one for Dave McKean, and then one is a drawing that a lucky fan who pre-orders the book can win. Mm-hmm. And he's great to work for, because he basically, the only parameter he gave me was that he wanted it to be 10 inches tall. And I emailed back and said, is 16 okay? Because 10 is really small. And the smaller you get, the harder it is to work. I mean, it's just things get too tiny and you know, you start having to use tweezers to do everything.
And there's already, just from the photos and videos you've been posting, there's already such an amazing amount of sort of small detail work,
mm-hmm.
even at the size you're working at.
Yeah, and that's a very different thing. For stage, we say that something is fine if it's, you know, we have the phrase 40 feet on a galloping horse, which means that if you are 40 feet away on a galloping horse and you don't know whatever the flaw, you don't notice the flaw, mm-hmm. then it's fine. The audience won't see it. And it's completely true. I have had puppets that were held together with tape and had people come up to me and say, my God, such a gorgeous puppet. May I take a photo? And I'm like, no, really? No.
You want to stay at audience length?
Yes, right? please. For this, knowing that these are for exhibit, I have mm-hmm. to be really, I can't let anything slide. So I'm really building more with the television mentality, which is you have to be ready for an extreme close up at all times.
Well, and I guess since they're dolls, they're not moving, that might also, there's not as much sort of mechanism.
Right. And it, which is also very interesting. It's really hard. I mean, I'm a puppeteer. I build puppets. I'm not a doll maker. And it's mm-hmm. really hard for me to let go of this needs to move well.
And it's actually the at the moment where you described it as a doll, I had that sudden realization that this is not like a puppet.
No, no,
it doesn't move, and I hadn't thought about that distinction until right there.
Yeah, well, because I'm building it like a puppet. If I don't have the perfect range of movement, I am forcing myself to be okay with that. I am actually putting rods in it. It's going to have a small rod in the back of the head and rods at the wrists, so someone could do some performance with it, but it's so small, and the people who are getting it are not performers. And what are you going to do with, you know, one character?
That's true. That's true. It's a very small cast. You do small puppet monologues.
Yes, which are oh so exciting.
Do you know how they selected you for this project? Or
I've done audio fiction for Bill, mm-hmm. and he knew that I was a puppet builder, and.
Okay.
I don't know if he had seen my Snow Queen puppet, which uses this technique, or if he just went, hey, Mary builds puppets, I wonder if she can make a doll. But the technique is perfectly suited for doing Dave McKean's art. The first time I saw his cover art for Coraline, in fact, I thought, hey, that looks like paper folding technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the doll you're making does look so much like the picture.
I fought for that, so thank you.
I only just today found the videos, the YouTube videos of the puppet. What prompts you to do that? Just the desire to sort of share the craft with people, or?
Mostly, yes. Actually, when I've been blogging or journaling online I can't remember how long, actually.
You've been doing it for long enough that you say blogging or journaling, which I think is a marker. The people who were doing this before it was called blogging.
Yeah, I really resented the word blogging for a long time. It's just such an ugly word.
That is exactly my objection to it.
Yeah, and I usually say, I for a long time insisted on saying journaling, but I've finally given in to the public pressure of blogging as the shorthand. And for a while I was like weblogging, but you quickly realize why that got shortened.
Yeah.
It's.
I try using web journal, but that hasn't caught on yet.
No, alas.
You've been doing this for a long time.
I've started, let's see, I could probably figure this out. I've probably been doing this online since 95. So, and I forgot why I was telling you that. Because when I first started doing this, I really, really wanted to be able to post video. Because there are some things that are just so hard to describe in words. And the fact that it's so easy now. During my recitation of how I became a puppeteer, I left out the part that I started doing puppetry in high school. There was a phase before I met the professional puppeteer where it was really hard to find information. And again, because I had wonderful teachers, it's part of the whole paying it forward thing. So that's part of why I'm wanting to do it. And part of it is also that because I am journaling and I know that my audience is split between people who are puppeteers and people who are really not, that when I talk about something, it's like, oh yeah, I installed a FETID control, and people are like, what the heck is a FETID control? So it's kind of my way of making puppetry more accessible for a wider audience. I've always felt that the more you educate an audience, the better on an audience they will be, and the more excited they'll be about the form. Some of it is wanting to mainstream puppetry. Puppetry and science fiction have a lot in common.
Really?
Yeah, in terms of being the redheaded stepchild of their parent art form.
Mm-hmm. Of being theater and literature,
yep.
respectively?
Or? Yeah.
Do they have sort of similar kinds of community behaviors as a result? Or
uh-huh, yeah, that? Absolutely. I find it people who, when you're talking about genre, it's and the people who are writing literature and refuse to admit that it's science fiction or fantasy, and you'll run into the same group of people in puppetry who are doing no, I'm doing figure theater, and people who will insist that they do not do puppetry. No.
But I have these questions, and I don't know. I'm worried I'm going to sound as ignorant as I am about the puppetry world.
That's fine.
So the sense of people insisting that they're not actually doing puppetry because that's sort of marginalized, has there been any change or any effect there after the success of something like, specifically after the success of Julie Taymor's Broadway
yes.
work?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. This is actually a discussion that I would love to have with science fiction writers. My opinion on mm-hmm. the... And I've seen this in puppetry, is that Avenue Q makes no pretense that it's anything other than a big old puppet show. And people in the New York Times a couple of months ago, they referred to puppetry as being the new black. that it is the theater of the possible. It's the way of discussing things that you can't discuss in any other medium, which probably sounds familiar.
It does.
And what I find is that when people stop trying to pretend that what they're doing is a puppet show, when they, let me try to explain this another way. George Latshaw said that he spent his entire life with one foot in theater and one foot in puppetry, and that what he wanted most was to stand with both his feet under him. So I think that is the ideal route, to not try to pretend that you are doing something other than theater, by that you're just trying to stay in your little genre, to not try to make puppetry something that it's not, but to take what is the best of both worlds and to use all of the things at your disposal. Instead of trying to bring a mainstream crowd to puppetry, you need to take puppetry into the mainstream by finding ways to incorporate it into shows that are not puppet shows. You know, it's one of the big debates that we have in puppetry is, when does it become a puppet show? When you have one puppet element in it?
Interesting.
You know, and it's like, when does something become speculative fiction?
Right.
And why, I understand why you need that for, you know, putting it on the bookshelf, but it's clear that you can have a story that has all of the speculative fiction elements in it that doesn't get shelved in spec fiction, and that audiences will love it. And it's, you know, I feel like if you want to reach, if you want to broaden the audience, it's not so much about bringing them into our ghetto, it's about breaking down the walls of the ghetto.
No, absolutely. That's something I've been preaching it to much of anyone except people I end up talking to at parties, but I've been kind of worked up about it for a while. I'm really tired of hearing people say that science fiction is dying or shrinking or contracting, because it's everywhere.
Yeah, everything. Absolutely.
I'm very frustrated with people who sort of say that movies and anime and television shows and all of this is not science fiction. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. It makes me simmer. I also foam at the mouth over these things. Yeah, I had a tirade the other day about the design of, because, you know, I'm a fairly visual person, but that I feel like the design of many magazines and books, I feel like it's designed to appeal to the people who are already in the community and people who have been in the community for a long time. But because of that, it's a very static design. And it's not exciting for people who are new to the community or people who might just be passing by. I took a photo the other day, which at some point I'll post on my blog, of a magazine rack. And all of the science fiction magazines are on the bottom in the back. And you look at the rack and you can kind of understand why. Because they look, not all of them, going to say that right up front, not all of them, but there is a tendency for them to look dated compared to the other things on the rack. And I think, you know, this is part of why we have trouble bringing in, you know, this is part of why things dwindle, is because we aren't reaching out to bring in new people. There's a great story, I think it's about Anheuser-Busch. They were huge. They were the number one beer in the U.S. And so they cut their advertising budget because everyone was buying them and they were on the top of the game. And funny thing, people stopped buying them.
Right.
So I feel like there are many things we could be doing to broaden our audiences in both puppetry and science fiction fantasy. So I'll just ramble about both kind of randomly and mixed together.
Well, again, not knowing anything about puppetry, it would never obviously have occurred to me that there were parallels, but it makes a lot of sense when you talk about it.
And we're all geeks, really, when it comes to it.
So I also wanted to talk to you about I'm not sure that there's going to be that much for you to say about it because you've detailed it in your journal, but the laptop case mod.
Oh, yes. Yeah. My husband and I collect vintage typewriters. We brought, we have 9 of them in our apartment. And one of the things about living with vintage typewriters is that you realize that something does not have to be ugly simply because it's utilitarian. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to bring some of that styling to my laptop, and it also solved my hankering for a new laptop. Yeah, it's like suddenly I want this one to last and last.
That's a useful
also
thing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it feels like it's a new machine, and it is, you know, it's ridiculous, but it's more pleasant to type on. And I have to say that the wood spacebar is so incredibly tactilely satisfying, which I will try to get pictures up by the time you post this podcast.
And we're going to pause here. The Strange Horizons interview with Mary Robinette Kowal continues in part two, which, if all went well, you should have downloaded along with part one. So see you in part two.